This week I watched, actually yesterday, I watched Godzilla vs. Kong.
Hey.
And I was going to watch it with Michael in the movie theaters, but
some things came up.
Pushed it back like 2 weeks and I just couldn't wait any longer. So I just pulled the
trigger. Had to see some monkey.
It was weird because in the movie they kept calling Kong a monkey. And I was like, SMH, put some respect on his name.
He's probably an ape.
Probably. There's just calling Kong. I mean,
that too.
Whatever. I watched it on HBO Max. Thank you, NYU, for that. Appreciate it. And it was meh.
Yeah.
It was pretty hyped up and
mostly by memes, which is the funny part.
I mean, see, I'm a fan of the MonsterVerse.
Right.
And I really liked Godzilla King of the Monsters, which a lot of people didn't like, really.
I wasn't a huge fan of that, but I loved Skull Island.
Yeah, Skull Island's pretty good. And I honestly, I feel like King of the Monsters was better than Godzilla vs. Kong.
Cool.
And
it took itself pretty seriously. Godzilla vs. Kong serious?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was weird. Like, it was relatively short. It was like an hour and 45 minutes. And it was like as soon as you hop in, there's just like all these things that they expect you to like, that it just like starts and there's no like explanation for stuff really. And I feel like King of the Monsters was, I was talking to my brother about this and he said that King of the Monsters was about people, especially like Kyle Chandler, Millie Bobby Brown, like there's actual like character development there. And it's a film about people that features monsters. And Godzilla vs. Kong is a film about the monsters that just have some people walking
around.
That's
what I heard as well, yeah.
And there's several fights between Godzilla vs. Kong.
That's so
sick. I'm going to spoil the movie. I don't even care.
Might be some people that have been waiting to see it for months, dude.
That's okay. You should have seen it already. It's the past the 2 week grace period. There were several fights between them, and then the very predictable happened. A third party shows up. Godzilla and Kong have to team up to beat the villain, and then they learn to share the world together.
I don't like that.
Yeah, I mean,
Batman versus Superman ended.
Yeah, you could see it coming because I feel like that's how
it was. It Mothra? Huh? Was Mothra the villain?
No.
Oh, okay.
You ready?
Was it Metalhead?
No. It was Mechagodzilla.
Oh yeah.
This like, electronic company, like this huge. See, it's always the rich electronic, intelligence company or whatever that becomes the villain. But they just made this Godzilla, and they used, the brain from the three-headed dragon, to like, control the Mecha Godzilla. So they're just a Godzilla of metal. And they unleashed it, and Mecha Godzilla was kind of really beating up Godzilla. And then Kong.
But the monkey comes in.
And then Kong comes back, saves the day. They team up. Super cool because Kong. I'm going on about.
We're going to talk about Singing in the Rain.
Kong has like this axe of some kind that can absorb the
nuclear reactor that comes out of Godzilla's
mouth. Yes, dude. Yeah. And so Godzilla was like,
that's convenient.
Godzilla was like laying on the ground like he just got beat up, and then Mechagodzilla was like about to like tear Kong to shreds, and then Godzilla just like sits up, and then he just like unleashes the blue blast or whatever, and then conveniently hits the axe, and then the axe like tears apart Mechagodzilla.
Dang. Because I really
the
won't
the fight it. Scenes the fight scenes were like pretty cool, I will say, but yeah. Like everything else was meh.
That makes sense. I think that's kind of what the movie's about, you know.
Yeah,
like that's excusable.
I totally apologize, everyone. You probably didn't come here to hear about that. In other news, I am vaxxed.
Nice.
Halfway. So that's exciting. And didn't feel any side effects, which is cool. Just my arm hurt really bad. But I got like 3 weeks or something until I get the second one. So
nice, dude.
Just vibing, you know?
Feels good.
Almost there. And
nothing else going on?
No. Same here. Super busy, as always.
Yeah.
We talk about this every week. It's like, oh, it's surprisingly busy out today. But it's like just normal.
Yeah, it's becoming normal, which is nice to see people out.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful day outside.
Yeah. It's a little chilly.
Yeah.
It's a little chilly for mid-April. But
I was late to work this morning.
Oh.
And so I took off my jacket and hustled. And I was the perfect temperature. Because I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt.
Let's
go. I got there and I was just a little bit sweaty.
Let's go.
Which is just like, okay, I did well.
You worked at Lipton, yeah?
Worked at Lipton Hall, for those of you that know what that is.
Was it in like the commuter lounge or something?
It was the commuter lounge, which is so nice down there.
It is super nice.
Super great. Made sure people sat 6 feet apart pretty much for 6 hours straight.
That's it?
Yeah. That's what I did.
Did you have to yell at anyone?
No, man. I don't yell at people. You just talk to them nicely.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
But yeah, it was it was nice.
This is a really strange start. Like,
yeah,
I don't know why.
Let's get into the movie.
Yeah,
I mean, I have okay, a lot
enough
to talk
of
about.
That. Let's just get into the film here. And so Michael picked this one.
Yes,
This
Singing
is,
in the Rain from 1952.
This is episode 10 of season 4, which is exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's still fun.
It is it's still fun.
It's nice. We're still having fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, I picked Singing in the Rain because it's really good. I love this movie. Watched this for the first time a very long time ago. Watched it like a lot of times since. There's a, what is it called? Fathom Events, which brings like old classic film into theaters, into AMC. I think it's AMC Fathom Events. They are linked together. They overcharge you to go see a old movie. I think I paid like $25 to go see Singing in the Rain.
Or
my parents did, honestly. Oh, I can't even act like I paid. But
thanks, Mom.
But yeah, no, that's just like my memory of this movie. Really great. And I didn't realize like I knew it was a great musical, but I didn't realize it was like a great movie considered that until coming to NYU, and that was one of the movies we watched. Everyone was required to watch as a freshman.
Mm.
There were about 12 movies. I'm trying to think if there are any others that we've watched on the pod so far. Dial In for Murder. No, we watched Rear Window, which is a different Hitchcock movie. But yeah, this was in among the 12 movies that I watched my first semester that the freshmen were all required to see to continue in film school. It's kind of how it worked. Singing in the Rain, 1952, directed by Gene Kelly, who's the main character. He directed it as well, co-directed it with Stanley Doren. Yeah. I intentionally did not ask Aiden about his opinion until we started. So Aiden, I guess I'll just say, I really love this movie. Like, this is one of the, I think similar to last week with The Irishman. I think it's better than The Irishman, but I think thinking back to The Irishman when I was having trouble putting into words, like, what makes it great? I think, or like similar to Pride and Prejudice, I suppose, like I finished this movie and I've put more effort into this episode than any other because I really spent like a couple hours researching and trying to figure out like what exactly sets this apart from not only other musicals, but, you know, what makes it a good movie and a good story in addition to being a good musical.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are my thoughts. I want to know what you thought.
Thank you for asking. I mean, I thought it was good. I don't think I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of my favorite films I've ever watched. In comparison to all the other ones on our list of 10 films so far, I would say it's like middle of the pack, probably.
Middle, okay. What's below it? Pride and Prejudice.
I haven't even thought about it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really scared for the end of the season when we have to rank them, because that's going to be really challenging.
I'm excited.
But, like, I'm just visualizing the list, and I'm like, eh, probably, like, in
middle.
Here somewhere.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So, that's fair.
Yeah. I like I said, middle of the pack probably. I will say for 1954, right? 1952 film, I was really impressed. Just with like there were several scenes where just the cinematography was really interesting.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I normally don't watch a lot of 1950s stuff, but I felt impressed that they were able to pull stuff like that off, and you know, make it still look good in 2020.
Yeah.
2021.
There's, I agree with that, and I'm gonna, maybe I'll start by talking about the cinematography, because it's a lot that goes into it. It's kind of, it's a lot to talk about, but comparing it to Dial M for Murder from 1954, I believe that was. Actually, no, I'm going to compare it to that later. So talking about the cinematography, the cinematography.
Tasty.
You're right. It was very impressive. There's a lot of big crane shots, which is something that you see today and don't think about.
Mm-hmm.
Every movie and its mother has a crane shot like today. And movies back then did as well, but I think you have to put some things into perspective and to figure some things out. So I'm going to go into that a bit, and this might take a minute. So bear with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Buckle up.
Yeah. So stuff filmed in color back then wasn't a lot. Up into the 1940s, only, I think, 5% of movies were filmed in color, because they used a lot of additive processes, which means you put a couple of filters over your film and it kind of makes a bluish red color, kind of what 3D looks like when you bought a 3D DVD for your DVD player at home. Mm-hmm. You had to wear those dumb red and blue glasses.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the look that like the additive color gave you back into the 1930s and 40s. And they hand painted frames of movies, and that took a while. And so not that many movies were filmed in color. A lot of people didn't like color anyway. Like, black and white was the way to watch it. And, I mean, till this day, you see black and white movies. Malcolm and Marie just came out on Netflix in black and white. Mank just came out in black and white on Netflix. And so there is an argument to be made of black and white is the way to watch movies. In 1939, the first Technicolor feature came out, which was Wizard of Oz. Yes.
Have you seen that, by the way? Malcolm and...
Yes.
Is it good?
Yes. It's very different. I think it's good just because of how it's not like much anything I've seen before. It has like shortcomings and flaws, but like it's pretty entertaining.
Who's the main?
It's John David Washington and Zendaya.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
No, all good. Technicolor introduced before 1939. It was introduced, but Wizard of Oz is the big Technicolor movie that everyone knows about. This movie, Singing in the Rain, was also shot in Technicolor. Apart from Technicolor, there isn't color at this time, pretty much. What they developed was something called the three-strip process. There were some MIT graduates people studying at MIT developed the three-strip process. So most film cameras and most every film camera you see today is running one strip of film through it. And at the time, cameras were running one strip of film through it. What they did is they ran three strips of film through it. The light went through a prism and divided it into two paths, the light that came in through the camera through the lens. Those two paths were divided and hit one green sensor or one green strip of film, and then what's called a bipack, which is the red and blue strips of film smashed onto each other. The blue has little bits of red in it that act as a filter for the red strip.
Mm-hmm.
So the light hits that and imprints on a blue and red strip together and a green strip. Those are then, so that's called a film negative. When a film is like raw, it's a negative. And so you flip it, kind of like you can flip an iPhone picture and it's like all blue and black,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
you used to be able to tap three times, right, on your mm-hmm. home button and flip your color on your phone. So
back when there were home buttons. Yeah,
exactly. So that's what the film looked like. And then you flipped it and got the normal looking color. But you still had a red, a blue, and a green three different images. So if I take an image of Aiden, I have a red strip of film, a blue one, and a green one. Mm-hmm. So you have the inverse of the negative, making it the positive. I don't think that's the technical name for it, though. And then you transfer those colors into magenta, which is the opposite of the green, the yellow, which is the opposite of the blue, and the cyan, which is the opposite of red. And once you put those together, you get your image. And then once that's done, you can tweak it with different solutions and formulas that the lab processes knew how to do and get your final look for the movie. So it's like a lot went into this. Mm-hmm. But it was the most beautiful color anybody had seen. It was real. This became obsolete eventually when they figured out how to do that in one strip of film, which is what we have today. And that's tweaked to get different looks as well. But that was originally how they did it. They had to use three different strips. Now, when you wanted to do Technicolor, you were required not only to buy the rent the camera and the special film, it also came with a DP, the director of photography, the cinematographer, who in this case was Harold Rosen. And it came with three assistant camera members. It came with a train car that they would pull into the studio that was the lab where they edited the film. And it came with the, I already said the camera and the lens, and it came with a color consultant. So you had like a lot of people that Technicolor shoved in with your production saying they're in charge of this. And like it was a monopoly. They had a monopoly on color and film. They didn't let movies, they had complete creative control over what movies looked like if people wanted their movie to be in color. You see this in from a year later, or maybe it was a year before, but Gene Kelly was in American in Paris, which is another musical. And the cinematographer of that wanted there to be more shadows because in the 1940s, everything had shadows in it and it looked great. And that's what people liked. And then Technicolor comes along and you have movies like Wizard of Oz, which has zero shadows in it. That's because Technicolor didn't want shadows in their movies. They said, this is our look. It's colorful. It's vibrant. It's nice. It's family friendly. We're not putting shadows in our movies. And American Paris famously has a dance number at the end with shadows in it because the cinematographer had got creative freedom. Singing in the Rain has no shadows in it. It's all lit up. Even in the Singing in the Rain scene when he's in the dark outside, it's like it looks like it's daytime out. Mm-hmm. They're doing nighttime lighting and it makes it look like it's night, but it's like all evenly lit. The background's lit. The places where there should be shadows are lit. The body and the face are all completely lit. And that's because Technicolor was in charge. So to get this all back, the federal government had to come in and say, okay, Technicolor, you have to let people have creative freedom. Like, the government got involved and were like, okay, let other people make the three-strip process too. Let them rent different cameras because everything was patented and no one was allowed to make color movies without these people from MIT controlling them. So that eventually changed, and their technology eventually became obsolete in the early 1950s, right before this movie came out. That's when that happened. But to draw us all back to you saying the cinematography is impressive, it is because they have this color specialist that's doing all the color. And in terms of the camera movement, I think about in Singing in the Rain, the actual dance number, Singing in the Rain. He's on the sidewalk dancing, and then he takes his umbrella and starts spinning in the street, and there's a big pan shot on a crane. It's like a beautiful, beautiful shot. What's crazy about that is you have this camera with three reels on top of it, rolling three different reels of film, which is big in itself. That's a big camera already. And that's not too much trouble to put on a crane, though, right? It was so loud from the three strips of film that it had to be put in something called a blimp. And what that was a 4-foot by 4-foot by 2-foot box that weighed 400 pounds. That concealed the sound from the camera. You had to like get rid of the sound somehow since they were recording sound on set. And so they would put it in this blimp. So really waving around in the air during amazing shots like that is a 400 to 500 pound camera, which is nuts.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. Cameras now get up to good heights like that, but we have better weights, not heights, but we have better equipment to carry that out. Mm-hmm. And it's rare, I think, that a camera gets up to 400 pounds these days. Mm-hmm. But it's just crazy. And a lot of work goes into getting those shots. The shot at the end in front of the billboard just a crazy push in from a huge ultra wide to a close up. Really impressive stuff there. But yeah, I'm going to hand it over to you because that was a long story.
Yeah. I don't know. A lot of my notes are content based.
Just do it.
I would say.
Do
it. Yeah, I guess just starting at the beginning. They ask him, the guy, Dan.
Don.
Don. Same thing, whatever.
Same name.
I kept writing down Dan. Wow, that's embarrassing.
Don Lockwood.
Don. Yeah, so they asked him, like, oh, how'd you get here, whatever. Like, tell us about your past or whatever. And then he looks directly into the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's, you know, normally saved for a very special time because it doesn't happen often. It's saved for a very special time in cinema. And I was thinking that, like, while he's talking and these scenes are playing out, like, everything that he's saying is a lie. And I am thinking that the fourth wall is just, like, a little, like, message or whatever to the audience that, like, oh, this is, like, our secret, you know?
Yeah.
Which I found super interesting. I thought it was actually comical that, like, going through his past, the different scenes, whenever he's voicing over, it's literally just like all fake. I thought that was
yeah, and that is funny. And a couple of things there, like there is a good sense of duality, which is like a very compelling thing, for lack of better words. It's a thing that's in movies, like duality is oftentimes dramatic irony, where a character, you know something about that character that someone else doesn't know, or you don't even know that they know about themselves. So, for instance, in this case, Don Lockwood is telling a story about his past that he's made himself believe. It's not true, and he knows it's not true, but like he believes it because he said it so many times, and everyone listening believes it. So there is a sense of duality where it's very blatant and obvious and like on the nose, but he's talking about the story, and it's just completely opposite things that he's actually talking about.
Mm-hmm.
About his like great upbringing of like wealth and success, when really that's not true at all.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happens later, and they're performing a love scene. Lena Lamont and Don are in the silent movie set, and so they don't have to speak their lines. So instead, they're like fighting with each other and arguing and, mm-hmm. and calling each other names while they're acting out a love scene,
mm-hmm.
which is like duality yeah. in another very literal sense. But it's compelling and it's fun to watch,
mm-hmm.
yeah, for sure. If you're moving on from that, I'll say one more thing.
Go ahead.
It's also the breaking of the fourth wall. I was thinking about a lot, and it just goes along with this is kind of a long point too, jeez, but I'll make it quick. So the breaking of the fourth wall, it's a movie that's about movies, and we've seen these before. But when he mm-hmm. breaks the fourth wall, he is talking to the audience. And there's one moment that made me realize that is because, I mean, that's always the case, that when you break the fourth wall, you're talking to the audience. But it's like literal, that they want you to be aware that this is an audience.
Mm-hmm.
When he's on stage with Lena right after the premiere and he's trying to get her to not give a speech because of her voice, the way her voice sounds, he oftentimes during his like, thank you guys so much, we love you, thank you for the support, he often looks at the camera, and the camera's sitting in the audience below him. And so it's very self-aware that it is. And there's a few other points that go with that. Like, I have written down, like, the premiere and the dignity speech. He is talking to the audience, and it makes it clear that you are the audience and that there's an audience there watching him. The sets become their set. You know, half of this movie is shot on movie sets anyway because they're on a movie studio.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very aware of that. And even times when it's not supposed to necessarily be a set, they run with it and make it a set anyway.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I want to compare to Dial In for Murder, is we talked about how clear it was that it was a set, and that was almost a drawback to the movie where it was like kind of hokey. When they look outside, it's clearly like a bad green screen, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Or blue screen back then. And this movie is just, you're hyper aware that it's a set and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's even transitions through walls with the camera. The camera just moves past walls as if it's like a dollhouse or a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they're okay with that. Most movies would cut and then show the other room.
Yeah.
But like they're okay with that as they dance through these rooms. And so it was very self-aware The dance number that uses a soundstage, like where he turns on lights and he turns on a fan and puts a ladder down, and like it's just very self-aware, and I think that adds a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think now that you've granted me permission to move on, I thought there was the scene where the owner of what was the name of the company?
Monumental.
Monumental.
Yeah.
Pictures. Yeah. The guy in charge of Monumental Pictures, he like shows everyone this crazy invention of sound being implemented into like a visual recording, and everyone was like, "Nah, that's fake," or like, "Nah, that'll blow over in like a week" or something like that. I found it. It was interesting, and then like it was almost as if the plot was just like built off that. And it was interesting that it wasn't necessarily like this film about like specifically Don and
Kathy
falling in love, or you know, this tension between the on camera couple between Don and
Kathy.
No.
Or Lena.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I'm so bad with names. That's like okay. Every film I just have no idea. But it wasn't specifically about one of those things. It was like it was, like that was a part of the film. But it was interesting that like in a lot of films, if it's a romance film, like that's the plot line, you know. But it was like the reason for all of these things happening was because, you know, sound got introduced into visual recording.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know,
Lena or Kathy or
Lena?
Lena? Yes, Lena.
Lena. Gotcha. Okay. At that point, you know, Lena is actually having to speak while she's acting, or like while they're recording stuff. And everyone just hates her voice. It's terrible, which I agree is pretty bad.
Which, by the way, I'll get into that later. Go ahead.
I lost my point. GG. I don't know. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It does. No,
like,
it does.
Like, it wasn't specifically just like a straight up like Don falling in love with Kathy.
Yeah,
it
no, and like, there's a lot of that's very relevant to the time, and that's a big thing I want to talk about. And you're right. And it's impressive that a story is built around.
It was like taking us through history.
Almost. Yeah, and yes, exactly. And it was they get a story across with a bunch of random music numbers that have nothing to do with the story.
But I like them.
Yes.
They're great.
Exactly, but they're amazing. And so that has a lot to do with it. I wanted to quickly add, Gene Hagen, who plays Lena, doesn't talk like that. She had a very successful career. And like this was, I think she was nominated for the Academy Award for this role, for Best Supporting Actress. But yeah, that was like, that's not how she always talks.
Thank goodness, bro.
Yeah.
There's several films in our season where like you can tell who the bad, I'm doing air quotes, the bad guy is, and we talk about how well, you know, directors set up those characters, you know, and I feel like this was that Lena was one of those characters where it was just like. Like, just everything about her, just, like, right off the bat, you didn't like her at all.
Sure.
And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. I guess speaking of characters, like, the immediate setup of the characters is really well done, especially between Cosmo and Don.
Yeah.
Don, like, is this guy who lies and is pretty insecure. And, you know, that plays out in the movie, especially with his relationship with Kathy and, you know, his insecurity manifesting in his first interaction with her and how it messes him up after that. And Cosmo is this unappreciated guy who's really talented and is there to help, but it just is always overlooked. And that's emphasized from the moment he steps out of his car at the premiere and everyone says, oh, it's just him. Like, they're all let down. Because it's funny. You mentioned how, like, he presents the talking picture idea. It's the first time, like, anyone's seen movies with sound in them.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's like, oh, that's going to flop. And yeah. Cosmo says that's what they said about the horseless carriage. Like, Cosmo knows. He's like, yeah. no, that's going to yeah. be big. Later, it's his entire idea to make a musical.
Mm-hmm.
It's his entire idea to lip sync Kathy underneath Lena. It's his idea to the whole dream sequence thing of going back in time to like the Dancing Cavalier. The title Dancing Cavalier is his idea. So it's
what subtly, a smart guy.
He's a great guy, and it's subtly just this kind of emphasis on the fact that, you know, he's this little guy in the system and he's doing so much. And that's also, I think, a big relevant point to the movie as well. A few other things just off my page here. Amazing stunts.
Yeah.
There was some impressive stunt work in this, yeah. which I haven't noticed before.
Yeah.
I've been watching a lot of stunt work on YouTube, though, of like people teaching how to do stunts and like what that looks like on set. And I'm watching like him climbing onto a bus,
mm-hmm.
like, driving the helicopter, the plane into the shack. A bunch of stuff that happens in this. And it's like, these stunts are actually impressive. I like in that realm, there's really good special effects as well. Like editing effects. The sound mixing was really well done by like making sure the sound sounded bad as if it was like a early 1930s movie. Like a late 1920s movie,
mm-hmm.
intentionally making the sound worse was really well done, I thought. And the moment that always kind of blows my mind is when they're showing the scene from the Dancing Cavalier within the movie that's in color, and it fades to black and white, and it transitions to them being in the movie theater. That's always so impressive to me because that's easy to do in Premiere these days. It's like you click a button and it fades to black and white. You just desaturate the image.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't that easy at the time, I know. And like that moment of transition is like so well done. It's creative. And you see that in movies. You've seen that in movies throughout history because I think this is the first movie to ever do that. And I think probably one of the first movies to do the movie within a movie thing, because we see that again all the time now. There's a ton of movies about movies now.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the first, I believe. And the fact that they lended entire sequences and entire scenes to, you know, just showing the movie clip as it is and then showing people's reactions mm-hmm. as if it's two characters reacting is bold, I think, just to have the camera sitting on a TV, on a movie screen. Mm-hmm. I thought it was bold and really well done.
Yeah. I know we kind of touched on it earlier, but... one of my favorite parts was just the dancing scenes with Don and Cosmo.
Yeah.
It was like it was entertaining. It wasn't like boring or anything, which I was expecting. Like, just like weird points where people just like start breaking into dance stuff, especially like a 1920s dance.
Right.
I just was expecting to not be entertained, but I actually was. It was super interesting, and then. The part towards the end, I kind of like faded out while it was happening and I didn't realize it until the end. But there was like a 10-minute period where it's like the idea of the musical.
Closer to 15 of just like straight dancing.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's weird. Like they like pitch it and
took a break from the movie.
they pitched it and they jump forward in time and boom, it's done and it's like already happened and whatever. And then at the end, he's like, it just like fades out and he's like, and that's how the idea goes. And
he goes, I don't know what it's gonna look like. I have to visualize it.
I was so upset, dude. I was like, man, I really just committed 15 minutes to watching this entire performance of this musical, and nothing. R.I.P.
Yeah,
but that was a really good part. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you said that. And I was curious about that, about like how would you react to dancing scenes and whatnot.
I'm normally not one for dancing scenes,
right? And this movie's very special. I remember back to watching it with like a bunch of freshmen. I myself was a freshman at the time, and we all were watching it in this big theater. It was like 250 of us, I think, or 150 of us.
You say that like you're like
All these freshmen,
the senior, like, the freshmen.
No, but I was a freshman, too.
You're one of the 200.
We were watching it, and, like, after these dancing scenes, everyone was clapping. And, like, that didn't happen that many times in that semester. Like, there would sometimes be moments in movies where people would, like, scream or, like, start yelling. And sometime we were watching a documentary that was, like, really, really heavy emotional documentary, and people, like, threw things at the screen a couple of times. Like, that happened, too, but... Like, there were just moments of, like, these dance numbers end and, like, everyone claps and cheers. And, like, people stand up and clap. And, like, it's so impressive. And, like, that's also what this movie makes me think of. And I think it's – there's a lot of elements that go into it. Gene Kelly is, like, the perfect cross between, like – I'm not going to act like I know a ton about dancing. I don't know really anything about dancing. Mm-hmm. But he's like, it's a very impressive cross between choreography and directing, because he clearly has a director's vision of attitude and mood, and stage presence and interactions between characters. And he also just has amazing choreography. He has very specific choreography that's different than a lot of other people at the time. And so between his talent and like director's vision, I think these scenes really come alive. Cosmo, his character, played by, what's his name? Donald O'Connor. He is also a great dancer, but I think, like, you have to talk about Debbie Reynolds, who played Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly both grew up learning to dance, like, from the age of 12. Like, they were dancing and had trained their whole lives. Debbie Reynolds had never danced before this movie.
Mm.
And she had never been trained. She had, like, never danced. She had 3 months to learn the dances and train for them. And, like, the fact that she was able to do everything that they did in high heels, mm-hmm. like she's so good in this. Your eyes are always on her. There's, like, the scene where she pops out of the cake at the beginning and she's, like, the dancer at the party. Like, your eyes are on her the whole time. And that's intentional through the cinematography and, like, the makeup and the wardrobe. But like, she has such a stage presence. Like, she's so amazing. She's Carrie Fisher's mother, by the way. Princess Leia. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And it's just like the amount of talent like in those frames of just those three dancing is insane. And I was thinking about it in terms and next to like La La Land, for instance. And, you know, there's like things missing, I think, from La La Land, because you have really good songs in La La Land. You have a bunch of really catchy songs. Not only are they current, like they're like modern and a little jazzy, but like, and they're fun to listen to, but they're not really that great at singing in La La Land, and they're not really that great at dancing. So you're missing a couple of those things. This movie, although the songs are a bit dated at this point, they're all from the 50s and like oftentimes like referencing the 1920s in them and 30s. They're still really good songs. And these are, like, the best dancers in the world. Gene Kelly's up there with, like, Fred Astaire is, like, the best dancer on screen. Debbie Reynolds was amazing. Cosmo was amazing. The sequence you were talking about at the end featured Sid Charisse, who was in the Bandwagon, Silk Stockings, I think is the name of it. And, like, she is just incredible in those last two dance sequences at, like, the two dance clubs they were at. In the casino, and like all of those amazing talents mixed with like the director's vision of Gene Kelly, like the use of like the flowing sash on the white dress and like the way that like added to the scene, the climax of the dance where she was wearing the green dress in the club, the Broadway rhythm dance, like there's a slow build of them, she's dancing circles around him, and then like finally they're in unison at the climax of the song, like as the whole big band comes in. And like, that's also what I think I miss from other musicals, is like this mix of great music with great skill, which a lot of musicals have, but then just like those crescendoing to like just like such a height. And it's a visual height mixed with Technicolor and mixed with really good cinematography. And like, it really just nails it. And that happens in so many scenes. Even happens in like Make 'Em Laugh with Cosmo Kramer, where he's Cosmo Kramer, Cosmo Brown. Cosmo Kramer's from Seinfeld. But yeah, just the perfect mix. of everything, I thought.
Yeah. I wanted to toss in, there was a point where Don was walking through a studio and some other things were being filmed.
Yeah.
And some dude just like walks up to him and he has this mask on, like a part of a costume. And Don is like, "Hey, George."
Yeah.
And like knows exactly who he is. And I just found that really interesting. I thought that was like a really good example of just like the character that Don was.
Uh-huh.
I think it helped by like just at the beginning of the film we see the humble, like how humble he's become just because of where he is compared to where he's been, you know, and just everything that he's been through. And so I just found it interesting that, you know, just a simple thing is him walking through a studio and saying hello to, you know, a fellow coworker.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, you would have to like literally go out of your way to know that like this character, like
this guy is
this, you know, extra or whatever.
Sure.
And I just thought that was super interesting that they included that and really like intentionally wanted to develop that character that way.
Yeah. But no, I agree. And that also, you use the word coworker, which is like so fitting because there's also a lot in this movie that like goes back to the old studio system and really emphasizes that. Like there's a lot of history in this movie that, and it uses the past to talk about the present, I think, because it uses, you know, the transition from silent to sound movies, as they call it in the movie, talking pictures. They use that, to talk about, I think, the transition that was taking place in Hollywood at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So in World War II, film was huge. People went to the movies a lot. Like there were a lot of families without dads at home that were going to the movies, and just people in general, like as a morale booster, there was a lot of propaganda coming to the movies about World War II, and people were eating it up, and as that's understandable. And, you know, it was very popular during World War II. Soldiers came home after World War II at the end of the mid to the end of the 40s and were starting families. They were buying cars, houses, appliances, and like were not concerned with the movies. More and more families were staying home and listening to the radio. And eventually when the TVs came out, were watching TVs, and the movies took like a harsh decline. At that same time, Hollywood, you know, has a real golden era in the 1930s, and it begins to decline at the end of the 1940s. A lot of executives are pushed out for younger people that didn't really know what they were doing. And so movies just really, in Hollywood in general, really took a decline. And eventually, like, film students in the 70s and late 60s started making movies, and like that was another golden age that happened. And it kind of went on until the 90s, and there was a little dip, and now we're where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of just repeats itself. But I think talking about the transition from the 19, you know, from silent to talking pictures was, I think, Gene Kelly's way of talking about the transition that was taking place after World War II in Hollywood. Previously, or right after this, Gene Kelly signed a 19-month deal with MGM where he went international and made some movies. He was kept from making Guys and Dolls, which is an okay musical. It probably would have been better if he was on board, but it was very regimented as far as like what you're able to do, because of the way studios were. This movie, as I mentioned, and this is what reminded me of this whole point, it makes a lot of references to like, all right, everyone go home. Back then, you worked 9 to 5 at a studio and you went home and ate dinner with your family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you work for 13 hours on set because it's like all been, everything's independent. Everything's like in a union. It's you represent yourself. You're not tied to the studios like you used to be. Back mm-hmm. then, like Gene Kelly, for 19 months with MGM, wasn't allowed to pick what project to do. No one was. You're like a boom on, from if you were like a production assistant to like a director, you were told by producers where you're going to go, what movies you were going to make. That went for actors as well.
Mm.
And that eventually fell through a little bit after this time, and you were able to do whatever you wanted. But this kind of gives a lot of references to that as well. Like him being a coworker with this guy and just walking around and, you know, saying, "Hey, what's up?" And like, that was just kind of like a subtle I think, attention to that. And it's really interesting. But all that to say, like, it talks about times changing, and you have this guy who's insecure and is told by Kathy that he's, like, you know, not a real actor. He's like, Cosmo, am I a real actor? And he's getting old, and he's, like, getting ready to move on. But it's also a story of, like, he has his place still. Like, he's able to make something of times changing. He's able to revolutionize, like, talking pictures by making it into a musical. He's also able to welcome in Kathy, who's this young, up-and-coming person.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, she makes it big because of him and, like, because of the studio. And so, like, it is, like, a story of triumph through times changing. And it was very relevant to what was... they were talking about a different time, but it was very relevant to what was happening at Hollywood at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would you say is the best musical you've ever seen?
Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
Yeah. I like musicals. I should add, Gene Kelly also directed Hello, Dolly! In 1969, after the MGM thing, after he was, like, not making very good musicals. He came back and made Hello, Dolly! With Barbra Streisand and Walter Matthau, and it was a hit. And it's a really good movie. But yes, that just reminded me because you were asking about musicals. Yeah, I would say Singing in the Rain is my favorite. I think it's probably the best one I've ever seen. Hello, Dolly! Is very good. Like, it's hard because then you compare it to, like, stage musicals, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Like, that you've seen on Broadway, and, like, that's completely different, too. I love Les Mis. I don't like the movie, though, like, the movie version. Mm-hmm. Like, but, yeah, I don't know. Like, classic Hollywood musicals, this is definitely, I think, my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And that stretches to today, because, like, La La Land's very good, but this is still definitely my favorite. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that's, like, some history of it. I think it is important also to talk a bit about... I have under themes that Don lets go of his ego and, like, helps promote Kathy and helps bring her on. But I think it's important to talk about Gene Kelly on set as well, because that wasn't necessarily the case. Because Gene Kelly directed and acted in this, obviously, and he was very harsh. Very, like, very harsh.
Some tea.
Yeah, so, he was extreme. He went to extremes. And, you know, there's a lot of talk of, like, you know, Kubrick was the same way, went to extremes. There's talk of, like, Tarantino, not in the quite the same way, but, like, things happening on set with Tarantino that make actors uncomfortable and whatnot. And so there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of directors that go to extremes. I think Gene Kelly was one of them. And a lot of times it turns out for really great movies. And, like, you have to ask yourself, like, what are the morals of that? Because they're getting this product that they know they can get out of people, but, you know, they're also potentially destroying relationships and hurting people. So, but he was extreme. He caught pneumonia from the Singing in the Rain scene and was close to death because of that. Like, he just was in water for a very long time filming that. But him on
set. That's crazy.
Yeah, him on set. As I mentioned before, Debbie Reynolds, who he got a very good performance out of, she was amazing in this movie, but he was extremely harsh on her. We never complimented her and was only critical of her performances during rehearsals, and just her dancing was very critical. She was known to, like, crawl under the piano on set and cry, like, when no one was looking.
Yikes.
And Fred Astaire, another huge dancer at the time, would come and say, "Hey, you're not going to die. Like, if you're not sweating while dancing, you're not doing it right. So, like, you're doing well. You just got to keep trying." So he was there to encourage her, luckily. But, yeah, Gene Kelly was not very nice to her. They did the Good Morning Dance for 15 hours straight.
That's crazy.
Danced it. Her shoes were, her feet were bleeding. Her shoes were filled with blood. And at the end of it, had to be carried off set. And was in bed for 2 days. And they ended up using the first take of the dance in the final cut.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, like, he was just extreme and went to extremes to get what he wanted. She's talked about it afterwards. Like, she's talked about it more recently. She passed away a couple years ago. But she was thankful that he did that because she was glad she was pushed. But she's still, there was a bit of resentment of, like, he wasn't nice. Like, And he, after the fact as well, said, like, yeah, I sometimes, like, I feel really bad about that. I'm surprised she talked to me after the movie. Like, I'm surprised we remained, you know, acquaintances. But, yeah, he definitely went to extremes. And, again, it's like, I don't know when you're allowed to get to that point where you, like, treat people like that to get a good movie. Because, obviously, like, someone right out of college, everyone's just going to think you're a jerk and not put up with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look at this movie and see how great it is, and it's like, that wouldn't have happened without behavior like that.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's like,
it's tough. Yeah.
It's tough. But he was like really tough on everyone on set. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I mentioned this a little briefly before. This is just wrapping up. Like, you can't really say, we didn't talk, I guess we talked a good amount about the musical numbers, but like, you can't really talk enough about them because of how good they are. There's a few in there that have nothing to do with the story, including like a 15-minute chunk in the third act that we talked about. Beautiful Girls, which is like this like number to show what the studio's been up to. Make 'em Laugh has something to do with the story, but not really. You know, you have all these dance numbers that are put in the movie, but they're so in place. And even though they don't have that much to do with the movie, they have their place because I think ultimately the movie is meant to entertain. And we talked a bit about this, and I know you and I have had private conversations about entertainment versus quality. You know, you look at Kong Skull Island as like a movie that's just meant to entertain, and maybe it shouldn't be looked at the same way as The Irishman. But it's interesting
that torn to shreds.
But it is also interesting that a movie like Singing in the Rain arguably could be looked at like both. You can look at it as this like marvel of cinematography and of directing and performance. And it's also like, wow, this is entertaining. Like, this is possibly one of the more entertaining movies we've watched in the podcast, or in my opinion. And like, it really bridges the gap between something that's meant to like make audiences have fun and just be a great movie. And I think that's like just my way of summing it up is like the really just the perfect bridge between those two things. Yeah.
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 Have you seen Mamma Mia?
I have.
What are your thoughts?
It's good. The music's good. It's not my favorite.
Okay.
Yeah, not my favorite. But I've always also wanted to see, like, I've never seen like the stage performance either. I've only seen the movie.
Yeah.
Which I understand is often super different.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, very different. Yeah.
But yeah, another thing. One last thing. It's important because the changes in camera during dances never seem to be. There's a couple times there's a weird cut in the middle of a dance because they need to film something in two parts, but that's pretty rare. In a lot of movies, they cut a lot in dances so they don't have to do a lot in one take. But there's a lot of times in this movie where it's long stretches of them doing a long sequence of a dance, and that's really impressive. And a lot of times the cuts aren't just random cuts so that they can take a break. They're cuts so that you can see a different part of the room and so that they're able to get a better camera angle. So the cut feels intentional and feels natural. And maybe that's also good choreography, knowing, okay, we're going to not be able to do this whole stretch without, you know, messing up. So let's run to the side of the room so the camera has to change over there. And that's just good directing as well and good choreography. But it felt very intentional and never felt like, oh, they're cutting to get away from having to do that all in one take. It always felt like the kind of cuts that are meant to be edited and meant to be in movies. So, yeah. I'm sorry I talked so much there.
Hey, no, it's okay.
But yeah.
It's all good. I am interested in what you had to say. So I'll gladly give you the mic all day. Is there anything else? Are we good?
I think just for some perspective, I guess. Like,
perspective.
I struggle not putting this in my top five movies of all time. Like, in terms of like nostalgia and of just like what I think is best, but I think I can say that this is probably a better movie than Pride and Prejudice. And I think I might like Pride and Prejudice more, but I think I can say like this is objectively a better movie, and I think it's probably the best movie we watched this semester.
Mm.
I will say that.
Wow.
I'll say that.
This is a okay. We have some updates. I have a list of things in my head to run through.
Okay.
First of all, at the end of season four, Michael and I will be doing a special episode.
Yes.
Giving a ranking for all the films.
And we're doing, we'll talk about this more maybe, but I'm thinking we're going to do what we think is best, not necessarily our favorite. Or we could do both.
Yeah, we'll do both. In addition, we have tossed around some ideas, maybe doing our own like Oscars ceremony, giving out like
best picture, best actor.
To all the films that we've watched. And then also maybe getting some opinions from some listeners, maybe a People's Choice Award. That'd be fun. Another thing, the film for episode 11.
That's right.
We are going to do...
This is Aiden's choice.
It's been very challenging finding something that Aiden has watched and Michael has not watched. but I am interested in seeing this movie. We're going to do the 2017 drama/comedy Lady Bird.
Directed by Greta Gerwig, mm-hmm. starring Saoirse Ronan.
Timothée Chalamet.
That's right. Lucas Hedges, my boy.
Yep. Oh, that's his second appearance.
Lucas Hedges, Manchester by the Sea, yes. and Lady Bird. Yeah, really good movie.
Yeah, I have not seen it. You can find it on Netflix. Yep. But going off of that, we've reached the halfway point in season four, and we're going to take a week break. Mm-hmm. We're at halftime. So
there'll be no pod next week, but then the week after that, we will come out with Lady Bird.
Yes, yeah. So in 2 weeks from now, you'll be hearing the newest episode. In addition, like we say every week, we just thank you so much for listening and, you know, engaging with us. It's interesting. My, like last Tuesday, I got a text at like 8:30 or something, and it was from my brother. And if you remember last episode, I said something about bike locks, and I mentioned, I think I said, bike parkers or something or like a bike parking space. And my brother texted me at like 8:30 on Tuesday and was like, they're called bike racks. And like, I don't know. That was just a cool experience for me because like, yeah, he's my brother.
But 8:30 and
like,
in the morning
and it's
Tuesday.
Like, he's my brother and he like kind of has to support me, but like by no means does he have to listen to my podcast, you know, but it's cool that like on Tuesdays, whenever he drives to work, he listens to the stuff that's that we really make. Great. And like, he doesn't even have to say like, hey, I listened to your podcast. He just says they're called bike racks. And like, I know exactly what he's talking about. Which is just a cool experience. You know, just going off of that, just having that experience with every people, not just specifically family members, but being able to have, you know, people that we're friends with and maybe some people that we're not even friends with, you know, just sending us messages and reaching out to us.
It's really encouraging. Like a family member of mine was like, you know, this podcast is like really good, which like was felt good. Like, this person wasn't just like, I think literally he was like, not just as like, okay, it was my dad, not just as like my son's doing a podcast and like, I'm proud of him, which he's like, well, I am, but like, he's like, but it is like, it's like actually good. It's like good to listen to. It's insightful, like, all these things. And so that's just super encouraging. And I've had people reach out and say, I had someone reach out and say, comment on the fact that I said, I don't not love a lot of movies. I had someone reach out and say, no, you did say that in the Arrival episode. You did say that you don't like a lot of
boom, let's go. So, yeah,
you were right.
Let's go.
But you know, and it's really great like to be like, no, I went back and listened and you did say that. And so
That's awesome.
You guys are I wouldn't be doing this like if people weren't. It would be a lot harder to do this if people weren't enjoying it.
Yeah. So, thank you. And so like kind of what you were saying about your dad relates to what I was saying, like your dad by no means has to listen, like he can support you or whatever, yeah, yeah. but he doesn't have to listen to your podcast. But the fact that he does listen to it and he enjoys it and like that's something he looks forward to, that's just really awesome.
And it's great. And it shows that, is this season 4?
Yeah.
It shows because we're on episode 10 and like we're missing next week and we're both like bummed that we're not going to be able to do next week. Like we are, it's a good place to take a break. I think it's smart to take a break and I'm going to be busy and that's why we're taking a break partially. But we're both like, oh, bummer, we're not going to have it next week. And that shows because in season 3, we kind of were like, yeah, let's wind down. This is it. We're done now around episode 8. And that's just kind of...
And then we took, like, the semester off.
And we took the semester off, and we're just, like, both hesitant to jump back in because we knew that, like, the podcast had fallen off in quality a bit in season 3. And so...
But we are back,
but
baby.
No, and I'm just saying, like, it feels great that, you know...
We found
something. I don't want to jinx anything, but we feel good about it, and we're so glad that you guys feel good about it, too, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's really awesome.
This is a really long episode. We really went on a tangent there. But, yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks with an episode on Lady Bird. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you then. Any last words, Michael?
This was extra long because you're going to listen to it twice in the next 2 weeks, or you're going to listen to it in 2 sittings. So, yeah, thank you guys so much, and see you soon.
Peace.